You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 206 by Rudolf Steiner, 11 Lectures, translated by Matthew Barton, entitled The Human Being as Spiritual Being, Evolving Through the Course of History. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 7th of August, 1921. If we wish to understand the meaning of the materialistic age, we have to trace human evolution insofar as this evolution involves all salient and essential powers at work in us. Today, firstly, let us consider this human evolution from a certain point of view. In doing so, I will refer also, with a particular purpose in mind, to various things I have presented recently. I have often pointed to the great significance of the period of an individual's developing life that coincides with second dentition, around the age of 6 or 7. This change of teeth means, of course, that certain forces that were present in the human organism up to then and were at work upon this organism become free in a certain way, no longer exercising the activity in which they were involved until then. At the moment this change of teeth begins and in the period or throughout the period it occurs, we have basically become a transformed being, one who has undergone a metamorphosis. What manifests in the appearance of the second teeth, in this expulsion of the second teeth, is something that previously worked within the human organism. And when it manifests, when in a sense it emancipates itself from the organism, then it appears by contrast to its previous activity as more of a force of soul. As we trace this occurrence, we arrive at the view that until this age of 7, a soul force was at work which we can say concludes its work upon the organism at second dentition. If we have acquired a certain inclination and capacity to observe these things, we can see how the child's whole soul constitution is transformed in this phase of life, how in particular the ability emerges from this phase of life onward to develop fully formed concepts, and how other soul capacities likewise emerge. Where did these soul capacities reside up to second dentition? They were in the organism, at work within it. What later becomes qualities of the psyche was first at work upon the organism. Here we arrive at a view of the interaction between soul and body that is very different from the one described, for instance, in all abstract psychological accounts that speak of psychophysical parallelism or of the abstract interplay between soul and body and such like. We arrive at a real understanding of what is, in an important way, at work in the human organism during the first 7 years of life. What has been hidden until this point, in a sense, and has now become free, appears as a power of soul. We need only develop the ability to perceive these things, and then we will see in this period of the human being's life, in these first 7 years, a certain system of forces at play, working bodily, whereas after this phase, they emerge as soul forces. And then we will also recognize what is at work really in the human organism, at least partly so, to develop its substance. We will see what is actually at work upon the human organism during these first 7 years. Now, when we enter a state of sleep, what I have described here plays a significant role in two successive conditions. We can also observe how the young child sleeps differently from the person who develops from this child after second dentition. The difference is not so marked, but it does exist. Up to the age of 7 or so, Young children cannot yet transmit to their state of sleep the state the soul intrinsically possesses in this condition in which we live between falling asleep and awakening, the soul forces they can later transmit with greater strength. Prior to the change of teeth, these forces are still involved in bodily processes, in the bodily organism. Thus, young children do not yet transmit clearly formed concepts to their state of sleep. As yet, they transmit to it only vaguely formed concepts, vague and more nebulous mental pictures. But these have the distinctive quality of being able to encompass soul spiritual reality better than can clearly delineated thoughts. This is important. The more sharply delineated our concepts become in waking life, the less we send forth into our state of sleep something that can encompass the realities living there. This is why the child will, in many cases, bring back from sleep a certain knowledge of spiritual reality. This then ceases to the degree that with the change of teeth, the forces I have described become free, and sharply delineated concepts arise, which then in turn affect sleep life. These sharply delineated concepts, in a sense, dull the gaze for the spiritual realities we inhabit between falling asleep and waking up again. What I have here expressed can be tested through supersensible vision, if this vision develops the strength I have often described. You can also find descriptions of this in my books titled Occult Science and titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. When supersensible vision develops the power of imagination, when, in other words, pictures emerge that we know are founded on spiritual realities, then we gradually become able to perceive the spiritual realities in whose midst we are during sleep. And then we can also judge the difference between the sleeping child before the age of 7 and after that age. Then we can discern how perception is dulled of what again grows very clear to us, in a sense, in imagination. Perception of these spiritual realities in whose midst we are during sleep. Once second dentition has begun, something that we can grasp in a particular way through imagination develops within the child's soul up to the time of puberty. Through imaginative perception, we gain experience of what here develops in the human soul. The experience I've just described in relation to the condition of sleep is only one of the experiences that can be discerned through imaginative vision. In those interesting states unfolding in the child between the change of teeth and puberty, we see that really a fierce battle is going on in the growing child. During this phase of life, the etheric body, which passes through its particular organizational developments then, is battling with the astral body. A real battle takes place in the child. And if we study what physically correlates with this state of battle, we can say that there is, in this phase of the child's life, a real battle being waged between the forces of growth and the forces that play into us through physical inspiration, through breathing. This is a very significant process at work within each person, one that should increasingly be studied if we are to know and understand human nature. You see, what partly becomes free through the change of teeth are the forces of growth. Of course, a considerable portion of these growth forces remain in the corporeal realm and there continue to instigate growth, but some of them become free at second dentition and appear then as powers of soul. But the growth forces that continue to work within the child fight against what now largely arises in the child through the breathing process. This could not previously arise. The breathing process is, of course, present in the young child too, but as long as children retain in their bodily growth and bodily organization the powers which then emerge at the change of teeth, Nothing occurs of what later brings about the breathing process in the human body in such a striking and important way. You see, a large part of the developmental processes we undergo are dependent on this breathing process. This is the reason for the Oriental practices that are particularly focused on the breathing process. Since by engaging with the breathing process in a way required by such exercises, one does actually connect with the forces pervading and organizing us that bring us into inner bodily mobility and which have something to do with a perception of the secrets of the world. Thus, before the change of teeth occurs, what breathing intrinsically wants of us cannot yet unfold its activity within the human organism. But then a battle begins as the forces, still available to growth, defend themselves against the influx of what penetrates the human being from the breathing process. And the first thing of great significance that arises as a consequence of the breathing process is, in fact, puberty. This connection between the breathing and puberty is something science has not yet recognized, but it exists. Really, we breathe in what endows us with puberty, but what also, in a larger sense, allows us to enter into a loving embrace of the world. Really, that is what we are breathing in. Something spiritual is also present within every natural process. The breathing process contains a spiritual and a soul-spiritual element which penetrates us through breathing. But it can only enter us once the forces that previously worked within the organism have become soul forces. That is, when the former cease to work in the organism at the change of teeth. Then what seeks to enter us does so through the breathing process. But this is counteracted, and this is what instigates the battle, by what comes from the growth processes that have remained such, by what, in other words, comes from the etheric forces. And this battle occurs between the etheric forces, which rise from our etheric body and find their physical correlation in a system of substances, in the metabolic system, in the circulation of the blood, and the astral forces. Here, metabolism plays into circulation, into the rhythmic system. And so, to show this schematically, we can say that we have our metabolic system, but that it plays into our blood rhythm, the blood rhythm system. I'll draw the metabolic system here, in white. This plays into the circulatory system. And this is what you can say storms upward from the etheric body in the human being in this period between the ages of 7 and 14. The astral body works against this. So we have an in-streaming of the rhythmic element in its physical correlate, originating in the breathing. And this battle occurs then between the blood circulation rhythm and the breathing rhythm. This is what inwardly unfolds in a person at this phase of life. And to speak somewhat pictorially, with a metaphor that may perhaps seem radical, we can say that roughly between the ages of 9 and 10, what has unfolded in every child as the prelude to battle in the preceding skirmishes turns into the battle proper. Astral body and etheric body join battle fully between the ages of 9 and 10. This is why it is so important for teachers to observe this moment in time, this period of time. As teachers, educators, and carers, we must pay careful heed to something which takes different forms in almost every person, but which does unfold between these ages. In every child, we can see this in a particular distinctive fashion. Certain qualities of temperament metamorphose, certain ideas arise. But above all, we should, at this time, begin to emphasize the difference and distinction between the I, capital, and the outer world. Whereas, previously, it is much better to protect the child from any awareness of this. Previously, we do well to speak to children through fairy tales and legends and so forth, as if the processes of nature were like human occurrences. We personify them, but then we can begin to teach the children about the natural world in a more teacherly way. Natural history, even in its most elementary form, is something that we should not teach children before this point. In the first phase of life, when children begin to fathom their eye more clearly, this is still a tentative first apprehension. They only start at this age to connect a more or less delineated concept with their eye. Only then do children learn to distinguish themselves fully from the outer world. And this corresponds to a very specific mutual assault waged between the breathing rhythm and the circulation rhythm, between the astral body and the etheric body. These things always have two aspects. One is apparent in waking life, as I have just described it. Things look somewhat different in the condition of sleep. If we have developed the power of imagination, and also something of the capacity of inspiration, so that we can judge what occurs through inspiration, through the breathing process that is its physical correlate, we find that at this point of development, and not until then, and for one child this comes earlier, for another later, but on average, between the ages of 9 and 10, the eye and the astral body truly detach themselves from the etheric and physical bodies during sleep. The young child's eye, especially, is very intimately bound up with the physical and etheric bodies, even during sleep. But from this period onward, the eye begins to light up like an autonomous entity, now that this eye and the astral body are no longer participating in the functions of the etheric and the physical body. Children who die before this time have in their life up to the age of 5, 6, 7, and even up to 8 or 9, something that has as yet hardly separated them from the world of soul and spirit we pass through between death and a new birth. Thus, children are drawn back relatively easily into this world of spirit and soul. They have only added a small piece onto the life they completed with conception or birth, whereas a true closing off from that previous existence through a new life really only comes about for children who die after this. Then their new life is not so closely or intensely tied up with their past existence. And only then does the soul clearly pass through the states I described in my book titled Theosophy. Children who die earlier are therefore thrown back, in a sense, to their past existence, and only add on a little piece of the experience they have briefly undergone on earth to the life they led up to conception or birth. What we see in the child up to this point, up to the ages of 9 or 10, contains a unity between body-soul and soul-spirit, which is much closer than is the case later on. Later we become a much more dualistic being than the younger child, whose spirit-soul is at work within and upon the body. The spirit and soul only manifest separately from the body-soul organism after this point in time. Thus we can say that from this time onward the human spirit and soul are less preoccupied with the child's bodily nature than they were before. As bodily being, the young child is a far more soulful being than we become later on. The child's body in its growth is still very much imbued with soul forces, since soul forces are still retained even when a great portion of them have transformed with a change of teeth. Gradually, from the age of 11 or 12, this battle subsides, and at puberty, the astral body then assumes its full role in the human constitution. But what has separated from the human being, and later, in a sense, is less preoccupied with the child's bodily nature, is then also what bears us back again through the portal of death into the world of spirit and soul when we die. As I said, at an early age, young children are thrown back more to their past existence Well, after the age of 9 or 10, they have separated themselves from it. And what detaches itself contains within it the seeds that enable us to pass through the portal of death. With imaginative perception, we can perceive these things very precisely and can point very exactly to the details of these processes. We can point to how the forces that arise here lead to sharply delineated concepts, dulling the spiritual realities in the midst of which we live during sleep, and make us into autonomous human beings. By encapsulating ourselves, by dulling the realities of the spirit, laterally, we become the spirit amongst spirits we must be when we pass through the portal of death. The young child continually slips into spirit realities, you might say. Later in life, we sunder ourselves from these spiritual realities, become static, stable within ourselves. However, what becomes stable in this way can only be discerned by employing knowledge gained through imagination and inspiration. Yet it is there in us. The process I referred to yesterday does indeed occur. If someone does not allow the science of the spirit to work upon them, then things are certainly as I described. What sunders and detaches itself, especially in the era where people only conceive of materialistic and intellectual concepts, when intellectualism and materialism already, and above all, inform children's schooling, for our various school subjects are now shaped by materialism, then what sunders itself acquires an Aramanic orientation. And because we are asleep, even during the day, in our will, thus also in our instincts, what detaches itself captures and captivates the instincts. We school ourselves to overcome this instinctual life if we absorb the concepts of spiritual science. Those who are mere intellectuals, materialists, and sensualists regard these spiritual scientific concepts as fantasies that have no bearing on reality. Such people only regard as real what their senses convey to them. But these concepts do not refer to such realities at all. None of the ideas and concepts you will find in my book titled Occult Science refer to the outer world of the senses, but describe instead a supersensible world. Someone who takes up these ideas absorbs concepts about this supersensible world, even if they cannot yet themselves perceive it. They absorb thoughts that are not applicable to the sensory physical world, and in doing so they also sunder themselves from aspects of the human being that are inherently connected with the physical sense world, that is, from the instincts. But this is the kind of schooling the human race needs. Otherwise, humanity would increasingly find itself embroiled in social chaos. You see, the true consequence, as I said yesterday, the true consequence of intellectualism and materialism in science, the true consequence altogether of our current scientific outlook, is a social condition of chaos as we are witnessing at present in such a dire form in Eastern Europe. As I said, you cannot discover how the philosophies of Mach, Avenarius, or Bergson are connected with Bolshevism simply by logical deduction. But real logic does reveal this. And this is something that contemporary humanity will need to pay heed to, that through developments over recent centuries, a dualism, a dichotomy, has arisen between natural science and human morals and ideals. On the one hand, we have a natural science that accepts only natural imperatives, as I have often described, that seeks to be rigorous and precise and lead everything back to certain originating contexts, causalities, as they are called. This natural science constructs itself a world edifice, forms hypotheses about the beginning and end of the world. In contrast to this, stands the human experience of moral and religious ideas. But this is entirely detached from what lives in natural science. This is why people make such strenuous efforts to justify this moral religious content through the mere certainties of faith, in quotes. They have raised this to the level of a real system in which such moral and religious content stands alone, and is left untouched by sensory phenomena and outward descriptions of the natural world. For they sense how these undermine each other, and cannot both survive side by side. And our modern view of nature, in its latest phase of uniting optics and electrodynamics, inevitably brings with it the idea of the world ending through heat. But then, when the world ends with all its humankind, there is no evolution of human souls, despite all human moral ideals. This ending of the world is subject to the law of the preservation of energy, which gives rise to it. The earth, with all its human beings, dies just as, in the materialistic view, the human soul dies with a human body. Only when we recognize that what lives in us as morality, what is pervaded by religious ideals, lies in us like a seed in a plant, which will manifest in the plant of the following year, only if we recognize that which lives morally in us is the beginning and germ of a future natural existence, that the earth, with all that it contains, that is visible to our eyes, audible to our ears, tangible to our other senses, is not subject to the law of the preservation of energy, but dies away, is shed from all human souls, who then realize their moral ideals in the form of a new natural world, as the states of existence of Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan. Only when we recognize that heaven and earth pass away, but my words, that is, the Logos, that elaborates itself in human souls, will not pass away. Only when we recognize the literal meaning of this word, only then can we honestly speak of our human soul as harboring a moral and religious content. Otherwise, such avowals are inauthentic. Otherwise, we place morality into the world, in a sense, and adhere to a certainty that is different from natural certainties. But if the words of Christ are true, we can know that morality initiates a cosmos that will wrest itself from dead husks when this cosmos crumbles into dust. And then we have a worldview that reveals stages of metamorphosis of both morality and the natural world. It is this thought that contemporary humanity must take to heart. You see, the thinking about nature that has developed in recent centuries does not enable us to arrive at even the simplest concept of society. The life of such a concept must consist of what morality at the same time discerns as its cosmic significance. As human beings, we must learn once again that we are cosmic beings. And until and unless we do so, and until we perceive how we are connected as human beings with cosmic intentions and cosmic entities, we will not know how to order social affairs here on the earth. This is the sense of things that must develop in people today, who inwardly feel the whole tragedy that has arisen through the gulf now yawning between natural science and moral outlooks. It may be that so far only a few have come to feel the whole significance of this gulf, but it must be bridged. It must once again become possible to give literal credence to a phrase such as this: heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. In other words, what germinates in the human soul will unfold precisely when the earth has gone under. But one cannot honestly subscribe to the law of the preservation of energy, and at the same time believe that the moral world has an eternal significance. Only by finding the courage to penetrate the nature of natural science from this precise center will we find a way through the chaos of the present era. This way through can only be found if human beings decide to return again, and now consciously, to the wisdom that humanity once instinctively possessed in those ancient mysteries. If humankind resolved to advance consciously toward the world of spirit, it would be found that an objective means to do so exists. Since the end of the 19th century, a wave has been rising in the world of spirit and is seeking entry to our physical world. It is storming in now, surging in. People need only open their hearts and minds, and this wave will speak to human hearts and souls. The supersensible world is full of goodwill, but humanity is still resisting. And the terrible events we have witnessed in the second decade of the 20th century are ultimately an expression of this strong resistance of humanity against the wave that wants to break in. And this is worst, one can say, where the spirit of science raises itself in opposition to this influx of the spiritual world. Having cultivated materialistic, intellectualistic habits of thought, people have no desire to take hold of what can be won from the spiritual world. In this respect, the wave of intellectualism and materialism reached its culmination in the second half of the 19th century. Of course, materialism had long antecedents. I have always pointed to its beginnings in world history. What lived in ancient Greece as materialism, in figures such as Democritus and others, was after all only a prelude. Materialism only gradually unfolded its world historical importance from the mid-15th century onward. Yes, it developed slowly, and even then feelings remained, albeit dogmatic ones, once living traditions had been extinguished, that a world of spirit exists just as much as does a physical world, and that this world of spirit can be grasped, though not through merely intellectual human attitudes. Today, many who do not yet discern essentials look back with a certain melancholy to times long gone, when even thinkers of a positivist and materialistic bent would have been ashamed to regard the nature of the human being in such entirely a-human ways. Such an outlook, in which the human being figures in entirely a-human terms, extinguishing what is intrinsically human, only really arose in the second half of the 19th century. As it were, in revenge for this, humankind then gradually developed a more or less entirely abstract way of thinking, as has emerged, for example, in the recent theory of relativity. It is therefore interesting to see that some still look back with nostalgia to times when even materialistically inclined minds wanted their investigations into human nature to be couched in terms of the human spirit. Auguste Comte was a thoroughly intellectual, positivist mind, but he did not live in the era of the late 19th century, by which time people had been entirely shut out from a human-oriented outlook. And since intellectualism and materialism only grasped the outward aspects of nature, only understood these externalities, they no longer paid heed to what is intrinsically human, or rather they did so only by conceiving of their own humanity in images of the natural world, drawn from outside human nature. And so it is interesting to read that an English thinker, Frederick Harrison, recently commented on the work of Auguste Comte, recalling what he called an incisive remark by Comte, which the latter had made over 70 years before. Auguste Comte, the positivist, the intellectual, was still touched by a faint sense of the spirituality of ancient times, and could see an age dawning when the human being as such would be entirely excluded. Despite his positivism, his intellectualism, Comte does not like what he sees approaching, although he never actually witnessed the form it later developed in the last third of the 19th century. Comte says that our modern doctors appear to him more or less like veterinary surgeons. By this he means, says Harrison, that they treat their patients, particularly women, as if they were horses or cows. Comte stressed that illnesses must usually be seen from more than one side, that they possess a psycho-spiritual aspect, and that this is even sometimes their predominant element. And thus a doctor ought to be as much a philosopher of the soul as an anatomist of the body. He claimed that true remedies have two aspects. And for this reason, Harrison continues, he would reject the one-sidedness of Freud. Harrison goes on to examine how this outlook of Comte's has been further developed in a particular way, but how people have increasingly succumbed to a point of view that treats people like horses and cows, so that human physicians have gradually become vets. He states that Auguste Comte's chief teaching is now invariably overlooked, that all is relative, which already contains within it the justified kernel of the relativity theory. This presiding principle of Comte's is better founded, says Harrison, and has a more fundamental depth in both philosophy and life than the theory of Einstein. Well, it is refreshing to hear someone saying such things nowadays, for we live in an age in which the scientific outlook resists everything that comes from the spiritual realm, and especially anything that seeks to lead the spirit into human life, into human actions, especially in fields as important as medicine. If we now ask what it is that makes materialism and intellectualism so attractive for modern science, we can become aware of how things come about. In the way modern education has been established, everything needs to encourage teachers to keep the child's whole nature and configuration at arm's length. Teachers are far too comfort-loving, and have themselves been educated to be so, to really engage with the subtleties of childhood development as I have described them. People are unwilling to engage with such things, for what do they demand of us? They ask us to be willing to find the transition from ordinary life, in which one lives in illusions, to a quite different life, where knowledge acquires reality. This transformation of the human being, this development of a different kind of human knowledge, is precisely what people shy away from today, what they wish to ignore. Rising to the highest truths should not involve them in too much effort or discomfort. But then such truths can only be extremely abstract, since that is all that can be attained in ease. Then one does not need to change oneself. And then also one cannot arrive at any real and living content, as this underlies our outward sensory existence. We cannot attain this unless we at least raise ourselves to concepts that make no sense for this ordinary life of the senses, whose meaning we first have to penetrate by the strength of our own inner impulses. The human being is rooted in a life that also reaches upward to this supersensible world, and in our era he needs a healthy light to be cast upon this world. When I said yesterday that the materialistic and intellectual outlook is not confined to a few scientifically trained people, but has become widespread, and now lives even in the simplest minds and popular ideas, even though they believe they still adhere to the old confessions and traditions, then it is now a matter of urgency that insights into the world of spirit should also flow into life in general and become widespread. But wherever efforts are made to inform areas of life with what can come from anthroposophic spiritual science, we repeatedly encounter the characteristic nature of the modern age. Into medicine, into religion, into the life of society, we must carry something that is free of all sectarian dogma, anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, something that displays the same scientific seriousness that has been cultivated within humankind since the mid-15th century in science, a discipline we entirely affirm. And when children have grown older, when they have the good fortune to benefit from some kind of higher education, well, you can see what this is like today. These young people, whether they train to be doctors, theologians, philologists, lawyers, and so forth, are not meant to change in the process. They are meant to remain as they are and only absorb whatever discipline they pursue in abstract form. Wherever an effort is made to offer something of real insight into the world, those who would prefer to live on in their comfortable abstractions reject it. But this will lead us toward chaos. And so we witness an interesting symptom, one I want to describe here. The Nuremberg preacher Geyer has been giving quite a few lectures in various places, and people who heard them soon detected, the scientists above all, that an attempt was here being made to apply anthroposophically oriented spiritual science to their various fields of study. They don't want it. Even well-meaning people don't want it, for they sense it would require them to relearn and rethink their whole scientific outlook, revise their own fundamental ideas. This is why they prefer to judge such things in terms of their own basic tenets, in terms of their own comfortable abstractions. Chief Medical Officer Kolb, director of Erlangen Sanatorium, and a psychiatrist, thus someone who ought by rights to welcome any beneficial light that is shown in the way only spiritual science can shine it upon the field of psychiatry, wrote an essay referring to Geyer's lectures. Spiritual science outlines healthy paths which the psychiatrist, by contrast, must pursue in morbid ways. And psychiatry itself can only become healthy if all its areas, all its aspects, receive health-giving illumination from what can be discovered through anthroposophic spiritual science. For this reason, psychiatrists should make efforts to allow spiritual science to penetrate their psychiatry, which has become nothing else really than a psychopathography. This field of psychiatry has become something dreadful today. What do psychiatrists do? They do not sense how the light that could come from anthroposophic spiritual science actually illumines the field of psychiatry, but instead they apply their psychiatric templates to it. They impose on it ideas they derive from what they already know in their field. And if they are well-meaning, this becomes especially interesting. You know what it's like, don't you, to look into a reflective ball in a garden and see your own face there. Your face may be beautiful, but in the spherical reflection, it becomes a caricature, albeit perhaps still a beautiful one. In the same way, spiritual science inevitably appears as a caricature when someone who resists it with all their strength describes it, however well-meaning they may be. Well, it's interesting to read a passage by this chief psychiatrist, Dr. Kolb, quote, "I regard the well-known anthroposophist Rudolf Steiner as," close quote, forgive me, I have to read what he writes, quote, "a brilliant but extremely unbalanced individual with various noticeable traits which only become comprehensible when one possesses a knowledge of psychiatry." The preacher Geyer in Nuremberg appears to have embraced Steiner's teachings. "I have twice attended a public lecture given by this highly regarded priest. Each lecture was an artistic delight, and I would consider it barbarism to pull to shreds the blue flower of poetry that was offered in such a charming way. Nor would I wish to dampen with critical colorings the blue scent," close quote. Blue, therefore, seems not to be a critical part of the scent, quote, "in which he paints for us the coming Steinerian era. But as a psychiatrist, there is just one thing I must say. Steiner's, in quotes, clairvoyance is nothing other than ordinary thinking pervaded by a kind of auto-hypnosis, albeit that of a brilliant and, I will for some time being assume, morally upstanding person," close quote. Soon, perhaps, that time will pass, quote, "of brilliant scientific and general education, and highly informed about current teachings in religion and philosophy. He looks into his brain and discerns its contents, anthroposophy," in quotes, "and offers the content of this brain as anthroposophy," in quotes, which, alongside numerous fantastical traits, also displays many good, noble, and morally upright ideas, even on occasion perhaps, ideas that are scientifically valuable. Close quote. Please attend well to this. Ordinary thinking, influenced by auto-hypnosis, looks into the brain and then represents it as anthroposophy. Please just consider this brilliant statement by the psychiatrist. It all comes when you examine the brain, when somewhat influenced by auto-suggestion. Quote, but if his teachings, so far accessible only to the cultured and educated, were to become widespread and popular, then less brilliant and less well-educated people would proclaim the products of their clairvoyance, in quotes, to the amazed masses. Close quote. These less educated ones have in fact already done so. It really seems as if this psychiatrist, who sees in anthroposophy a thinking influenced by auto-hypnosis that gazes into the brain, in fact lives elsewhere than in the real world. Quote, this occultism, like communism, possesses a fateful power of attraction for mental frailty, for immature youth, for the prematurely old, for fantasists, for hysterics, above all for psychopaths, pathological liars and swindlers. We would see prophets coming to the fore amongst our demoralized population, so weakened by war, death, poverty, and anxiety about the future. Prophets similar to those at whose deeds we shudder when we read of them in the history of Münster's Anabaptists. The Catholic Church has done us a great service by rejecting Steiner with utmost severity and decisiveness. Close quote. A severity and decisiveness you can find in the writings of people who live very close by to us here. Quote, and as a Protestant, I would warmly invite every single Protestant priest to very carefully examine this danger and the danger of collapse of our church into a dire and dangerous sectarianism before they recommend Steiner's dangerously seductive yet highly pathological teaching to idealistically minded Christians. Close quote. Well, this is the lecture given to Geyer by a psychiatrist, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Gustav Kolb, Director of Erlangen Sanatorium. You see, therefore, the frame of mind of someone who has entirely taken on board the modes of thought of the modern scientific outlook. And now, I would beg you to consider, or even to meditate a little on this. What would happen if instead of directing our gaze to the outer world, instead of sharpening this gaze through imagination, intuition, and inspiration, and thereby bringing forth such things as can be found in my title Occult Science, we directed our gaze inward to describe the human brain, somewhat influenced by auto-hypnosis. What the psychiatrist describes here is truly madness, this account of his couched in the views of psychiatry. But one has to say that someone, such as this Gustav Kolb, is actually well-meaning when he states that he ought not to dispel the blue scent with other critical colors, scatter the blue flower to shreds, that it would be barbaric to tread underfoot the poetic flower of Father Geyer. Yes, from one point of view he remains benevolent. And yet he is a really typical embodiment of the modern academic outlook. That is all we can hope for and expect from modern science, in respect of anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. And so we must keep reiterating that this anthroposophically oriented spiritual science would need active collaborators on the alert for everything of this kind that is presented, wherever it should surface, and then shine the right light on it, which we can do by pointing out, firstly, that modern science is incapable of seeing things in any other way than this, and secondly, that in such an outlook, the brain takes the place of anthroposophy. Yes, we must free ourselves from the preconception that we might be able to convince those fully embedded in such academic habits of modernity of a different mode of knowledge. It is misplaced to rejoice, as some short-sighted adherents of ours do, at the idea that they might draw this or that individual over to our way of seeing things. The important thing is to give open-minded people a full sense of what anthroposophically oriented spiritual science can offer, and at the same time unwaveringly to characterize the nature of modern scientific ideas wherever these turn out to be nonsense, even well-meaning nonsense. We are facing an enormously serious situation today, and so we must repeatedly stress that as many as possible amongst us who feel this gravity must stand up for what they believe, that rather than settling down passively and just listening, enjoying the warm glow they feel when they hear anthroposophic truths, they seek instead to introduce actively into life what anthroposophically oriented spiritual science aims to become for life. People who have the courage and energy to stand up wherever it is needed. I keep saying this. The battle being waged against spiritual science has assumed all kinds of grotesque, ridiculous, mendacious, and even well-meaning yet impotent forms. As yet, the battle against this battle remains very sparse and meager, but it must be fought for the sake of humanity's continuing evolution. As you know, the modern scientific spirit is fully recognized and esteemed by spiritual science wherever it is justified. But wherever it causes sickness, because it intrudes into fields of which it understands nothing, this sickness must be cured and healed. The end of Lecture 6.